KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, in today for Sean Spruce. The U.S. government is on the hook for more than $23 billion for funneling money into Indian boarding schools rather than living up to the trust responsibility. That's the contention of a federal lawsuit by two tribes who say U.S. officials mismanaged the assets they derived from Native Americans. We'll find out about the innovative legal strategy and other updates and concerns over boarding school awareness right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Congress is considering a rescission request from the Trump administration to pull funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. As SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports, the maneuver would negatively affect many tribal radio stations, including four in South Dakota.
You're listening to KOYA 88.1 FM, Rosebud, St. Francis.
The station KOYA stands to lose about $200,000 if Congress ultimately approves the rescission. John Miller is the manager for the station in Rosebud. He says the funding reduction would be very detrimental.
For the folks of the Rosebud, we serve a purpose of keeping them up to date, passing along, you know, emergency information, passing along pertinent information that helps them in every way and every day. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding that we do receive is very, very beneficial in keeping the station on the air. It wouldn't be a good outcome for us.
KILI of Porcupine, KDKO of Lake Andes, and KLND of McLaughlin all stand to lose around $200,000 in CPB grants. South Dakota's lone representative in the U.S. House, Republican Dusty Johnson, voted in favor of rescinding the money. South Dakota Republican U.S. Senator Mike Rounds says he does not want to see funding cut for radio stations in rural areas that rely on public broadcasting, particularly on reservations.
Let's not cut the stuff where we really do need to be able to help folks that are in some rural areas that simply, and on the reservations where they simply don't have other resources available to keep those radios in operation.
Rounds says his rescission decision will be based on whether the package can be amended to allow for funding to continue to reach rural radio stations. The rescission question now heads to the U.S. Senate. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Grassroots organizers gathered Thursday in Montana's largest city for a conference focused on combating the missing and murdered indigenous people crisis. Jackie Coffin reports from Billings.
Montana is home to 12 tribal nations, and about 7% of the state's population is Native American. But looking at Montana's current missing persons database, Native Americans are disproportionately represented, making up about 25% of all cases. Lita Pepion, co-founder of the Billings-based nonprofit Warrior Women for Justice, says she's tired of waiting for state and federal resources to make a dent in the problem.
We hear people all the time say, well, what's the council doing? What's the cops doing? What's everybody doing? What are we doing? Because it's not just their problem. It's our problem as well.
Pepion helped organize the two-day MMIP conference to share stories and strategies for searching for missing loved ones, advocating for their cases, and how to heal from the grief that comes with losing family members.
We've been under a state of trauma for so long.
Charlene Sleeper runs MMIP Billings, a grassroots advocacy program that develops research methods, trainings, and communication strategies for missing persons cases in Montana. A presenter at the conference, she feels the state-led effort in combating MMIP has stagnated.
If we as Indigenous women take the initiative to create our own solutions in a way that benefits our specific communities that we come from, they'll be far more effective and impactful.
Pepion says Warrior Women for Justice will hold future events centered around MMIP throughout the summer and fall. In Billings, I'm Jackie Coffin.
And I'm Brian Bull for National Native News from the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Arctic Encounter 2025, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Registration at arcticencounter.com, who support this show.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, sitting in for Sean Spruce. The federal government neglected its responsibility spelled out in treaties and agreements in exchange for millions of acres of land from tribes. Instead, the United States used proceeds from that exchange to further oppress Native Americans through a system of abusive boarding schools. Those are the arguments of the Washoe tribe and the Wichita and affiliated tribes in a lawsuit filed against Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and the U.S. government. The lawsuit details the loss of life, language, and culture that continues to haunt tribes and demands $23.3 billion to cover the bill. We'll hear about that today and talk about additional boarding school updates, including an apology from New York's governor and federal funding cuts. A warning, this show might not be suitable for all listeners. We will be discussing abuses during the boarding school era. Join our discussion with your comments or questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Oklahoma City in Oklahoma is Tasha Musso. She is the vice president of the Wichita and Affiliated Tribes, where she is an enrolled member. She's also Kiowa, Caddo, and Hunka Oglala Lakota. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Tasha.
Thank you, Andy. It's nice to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
So the Wichita Tribes Executive Committee unanimously voted to enter this lawsuit I mentioned in the intro. What is the Wichita Tribes' role in this fight?
So this is a class action suit. We are, along with our Washoe relatives, the main lead plaintiffs in the litigation. So essentially, you know, standing up as the face of this litigation for all of Indian country.
Okay. And what realizations did Wichita officials reach that prompted you to take on the federal government?
The experience of the Wichita and affiliated tribe citizens is not unique to us. Across Indian country, we know that all of our tribal nations and citizens have connections to the boarding school era. The federal government has even released a report last year that denotes all of the atrocities that were perpetrated against our people during this horrific 150-year period of time that, you know, was dedicated to the wholesale destruction of our cultures and our family systems. So, you know, it was not a hard decision to make, and really realizing that this is a multi-layered issue. There are so many people working on different aspects of this, but this is an ecosystem of puzzle pieces that need to be put together so that we get a true and accurate history and accounting of everything that our ancestors experienced. And I think that is one of the only pathways to healing for our people.
Okay. And what do you hope this lawsuit accomplishes?
So, of course, we would want to prevail in this lawsuit for a variety of reasons. There is this invisibility that exists among Native people, and highlighting this experience that we were able to overcome and be resilient through is important. It's also important to speak to the things that others value. So while we are very focused on the human impact of the boarding schools that has, you know, had a legacy into how we behave in our families today and how we're related to each other and utilize our kinship systems and language or do not, when we talk about the federal government, dollars and cents speak to them. This is a way in which, you know, $23 billion in accounting that needs to happen will resonate with the federal government in a very different way. And again, I think it's one way to look at this, but it also validates all of the experiences and stories of our ancestors that went through this horrible period of time. We know that these stories are true through our oral histories and our family histories. This is another way that provides evidence of just the extreme measures that were taken to assimilate our people.
Okay. And in the intro, I just spoke a little bit about the details of this case, but I know there's so much more to it. What is the investment that the federal government squandered away from the tribe, and how was that calculated? How did you guys come up with $23.3 billion that the United States owes the tribes?
Our attorneys at DiCello Levitt are really great and wonderful partners and allies in Indian country. So they did a lot of the heavy lifting in determining these numbers and adjusting them for inflation and current terms. And so that is where the $23 billion estimate comes. And it is in reference to, you know, at certain times, over 90% of the funds that supported boarding schools came from Native people's own money, and it was pulled together to pay for those schools. And so the, you know, the boarding school report was helpful and really looking at, you know, millions of documents over that period of time that allowed us to do some forensic accounting, if you will, to come up with that number.
Okay. And what is the investment? What money was squandered away by the government?
The full $23 billion. And I don't know that squandered. I think that they accomplished their goal with what they wanted to do with these funds. However, there was a mismanagement of those funds that were ours with that trust and treaty responsibility that exists, still exists today. It's never ended, and nor has it been revoked. And so these in this trust responsibility, they have failed to look out for and accomplish their fiduciary responsibility to our Indigenous people.
Okay. And I just want to put this disclaimer out there. We reached out to the BIA for comment on this lawsuit, and they declined and said the department does not comment on ongoing litigation. Vice President Musso, what kind of arguments do you expect to hear from the government about this issue?
At this point, with the current political and legislative environment in the United States, I really couldn't speculate on what responses or legal arguments may come in response to this litigation. But what I can tell you is that if we are following the letter of the law, and if we are, in fact, living within the purview that treaties are the supreme law of the land, and that the United States government does have trust and treaty responsibilities to Native peoples, then we will prevail.
Okay. Can you describe the effects of boarding schools on your tribe?
again, not unique to the Wichita-affiliated tribes. When I think about the boarding school era and all of the atrocities that our people had to endure, we see those effects ripple into our current lives and somewhat into the future. Anything from how we rear our children when our ancestors and relatives were exposed to corporal punishment as a means of getting compliance. They brought that back home in the ways that in which they disciplined their children and interacted with their significant other. So we see, you know, that child abuse and domestic violence and those sorts of things continue to happen in our community. When you look at the dismal rates of graduation for our people nationwide, it is no wonder that those exist, because the education system was weaponized against our people. So we see all of these impacts. We also see in those generations PTSD, behavioral health concerns and challenges, and those impact entire family systems. And when that ripples out, it impacts our communities. Rippling out further, it impacts our tribal nations. So these are all things that we're grappling with right now as a direct result of the boarding school experience.
Okay, and you're currently attending the Tribal Sovereignty Symposium in Oklahoma City. From conversations you're having with other tribal leaders, do you get a sense of confidence that the Trump administration and federal officials will keep momentum going to address boarding school history, like what we heard from the previous administration, President Biden's apology, and then the whole initiative by Secretary Deb Haaland?
So yes, I'm at the Sovereignty Symposium here in Oklahoma City. Have to also note that this is the traditional homelands of my people, the Gitgit East people. So very happy that we are one of the few tribes that still is on our ancestral homeland. And funny you should ask, our keynote speaker today is former Secretary Deb Haaland. I'm actually at an event for her right now, just stepped out to do this interview. And she talked at length about the work that was accomplished under the last administration, President Biden's apology, which in my opinion is a great first step. He did what others either could not or would not do previously. She spoke to his willingness almost immediately to support these boarding school efforts and make that apology. And the concern that I'm hearing across Indian country is that that it won't continue on under this administration, that it is not a priority. And we've seen.
All right. We will be back after this break. We are talking about updates in boarding school reconciliation and acknowledgement. You can join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Land important to Native Americans could lose its current protections as the White House pushes to reverse the status of several national monuments. At the same time, legislation in Congress proposes selling off millions of acres of federal land, forever taking them out of any stewardship or conservation considerations. We'll hear about what that means for tribes on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're looking at recent updates on acknowledging the history of Indian boarding schools. You can join our conversation or with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now to help us talk about reactions to an apology for boarding schools made by New York Governor Hochul. I want to bring in Dr. Lori Quigley. She is a professor and department chair for the PhD in Leadership and Policy Program at Niagara University and a longtime educational consultant. She is a member of the Seneca Nation from the Wolf Clan. Welcome to Native America Calling, Lori.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. And joining us from Salamanca, New York is J.C. Seneca. He's the president of the Seneca Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, President Seneca. All right. Well, Lori, we will start off with you. You're in New York, where the governor just issued her own apology related to boarding schools. What did you take away from that apology?
Well, first, I was really happy and really pleased that our president, J.C. Seneca, in one of his meetings with Governor Hochul, invited her to come to our Seneca Nation Cattaraugus territory in western New York just to consider to offer an apology. And although I was a bit skeptical in the beginning because I wasn't sure how she was going to offer an apology, because I actually believe that acknowledgement is something that is much stronger, when I watched her, the video streaming of her speech that day, I was really pleased that it became more of an acknowledgement of what happened at Thomas Indian School and the generational impact that Thomas Indian School has left, not only on our living survivors of the school, but also on the many descendants and families and our communities within the Seneca Nation and also beyond, because Thomas Indian School was a place where children from across the Six Nations communities and the two Long Island tribes were placed in New York State. And unique also that it was not a federal boarding school, but a state-run residential boarding school, which I don't think there are too many of those across the 50 states.
Okay.
So, yes, I was quite pleased that she did that. I think that it's part of, and I don't want to speak for President Seneca, but I believe that he's on the right path in, you know, building and rebuilding relationships with the state of New York, and in doing so, helping the state of New York to understand who we are as Seneca people, that we are not just a people of the past, that we are here, present, and a vibrant part of the society here.
All right. Thanks, Lori. I think we have President Seneca back. President Seneca, can you give your response to the apology you heard from Governor Kathy Hochul?
Hey, and hello, doctor. How are you? It's good to hear you. Hello?
All right, President, your reaction to the apology from the governor.
Well, thanks for having me on today, and then also appreciate that. And hello, doctor. It's good to hear your voice, and good to be on with you. And, you know, I think certainly, you know, there's a lot of questions in regards to why the governor was coming here. There was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of, you know, I think understandable concern about the governor's presence because of certainly the rocky relationship that we've had over the course of history with the state of New York. And, you know, from long ago and up until modern times. And so, you know, in my presidency here, I've been bringing forward a process of engagement, of communicating, trying to open up new lines of communication with the executive chamber. And when we had the opportunity to be able to go to Albany and meet with the governor, the Thomas Indian School was on my mind. It was, you know, it was the first issue that I addressed with the governor. And, you know, we talked about that. She was very engaged, very concerned about what she was hearing. We provided her with information and background in regards to what occurred here. And, you know, I asked her, I said, Governor, would you come to the Seneca Nation and apologize on behalf of New York State for what happened and their role here at the Thomas Indian School? And without hesitation, she said it was her moral responsibility to come and apologize for what happened. And so from that point forward, you know, a couple months later, on May 20th, she did come here and she did make an apology, and she did more than that. I think she, you know, gave her a heartfelt, you know, comforting to the survivors and the families of that. She sat and met with them and listened to their stories and interacted with them and talked with them. And I think, you know, I think the concern over her coming at that point was eased, because a lot of those folks that she talked to that were there afterwards felt a lot better, because they were able to talk about it. They were able to tell her the situation, the stories, the feelings, the emotions, the pain that is felt by them and by this generation currently that is here. And as the doctor said, it's intergenerational trauma from time and time, over and over, that still is a part of, you know, what happens here at Seneca and other territories here throughout the New York State, and perhaps the country and in Canada, from the effects of the boarding schools that it had on Native people on this continent. And so, you know, I think the more that we can do to be able to provide an opportunity and a space for our people to, you know, let that out, to be able to start or continue a healing process, I think that's an important thing. And that's kind of what I was looking for, is to be able to get the perpetrator, who was New York State, here to apologize, to again allow that process to continue, and hopefully continue through that, that will have a great effect on our people in the future and the next generation.
Okay. And after this apology, what is left to be done by New York to follow through with being apologetic, maybe turning that into action? And what can New York do to be a model for other states where similar abuses took place?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, New York, the governor has stepped forward. I don't know if any other state that's done what she has done. And so it is. It sets a precedent where other states could follow. And so, you know, as President Biden, and President Biden stepped forward and apologized on behalf of the United States for the federal schools, Governor Hochul has stepped forward in regards to the responsibility of the state and the role of this Thomas Indian School. And so, yeah, it sets that ability for other states to do that. And, you know, the governor mentioned in her speech that day about her putting money in her current budget in regards to education in the New York State public schools, in regards to the mistreatment of Native people of, throughout history, and wants to tell that story and let the students of today within New York learn and know about our Native people, where we live, where we came from, and, you know, the land that we're on. And she recognized that in a land acknowledgement statement in regards to knowing that this the land that a lot of New York State is on is Native land. And, you know, and that's an important also. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think following through on the governor's visit and her words is that, you know, as much effort and as much money as the state put forward in regards to trying to take away our language, our culture, our heritage, our traditions, they need to put money back forward that would be earmarked for on territory in our language and cultural programs to make sure that it's sustainable, that it grows, and that our people once again are able to be able to fluently speak our language, because certainly over time it has deteriorated. But there's a, you know, we have programs that are immersion programs that are right now in process of teaching and, you know, our language here on territory and even in the local school districts, but that's not enough. our population, our elder population that came from that generation that spoke our language fluently are, unfortunately not here with us anymore. And so the numbers are few in regards to that. And we have to make sure that we make a concerted effort in regards to stabilizing and then growing our language to the future.
All right. Thank you for that, President Seneca. I want to go back to Lori. Lori, President Trump issued an executive order to restore truth and sanity to American history. And the order says that there's been a revisionist movement to reconstruct America's legacy as inherently racist. As a longtime education consultant, what are the stakes in tearing into the boarding school narrative and history?
Well, first of all, as an education consultant, I'm hired by school districts and universities alike to present professional development training to address issues of systemic racism against our Indigenous students in both K-12 and higher ed situations. And I think that if we had more education about who we are, our history from our perspective, there would be much less need in the future for that kind of professional development training. Our teachers need it. It needs to be embedded in our teacher education programs, in our school leadership programs, in professional development training for faculty and staff in higher education across the country. Because I find it remarkable as a 40-year career woman in education of how little the American and Canadian public know of our history. And we're always thought of as people of the past. And so I agree with President Seneca. I hope that Governor Hochul follows through on her promise to begin to embed this information into our curriculum. Because as long as it's left out of the curriculum, that will continue to support the erasure of Indigenous peoples on this continent. And I think it's critically important for everyone. It's important for our own people to learn our history. It's important for non-Native people to learn our history. And so that these things that happened to us in the past are not repeated. And it is my hope that the current administration really thinks deeply and hard about that. And what they're really framing as racist. Because to me, it's a social justice issue. It is a social justice issue across this country.
All right. I want to ask President Seneca a similar question. You want to weigh in on the federal government addressing boarding school history and perhaps changing the current narrative of that history?
Well, certainly in my travels, as I travel to Washington, D.C. and engage with leadership there, as I travel to Albany to engage with the leadership there as well, we come across a lack of education by the representatives of the state of New York and representatives within the U.S. Congress. And so education is critical. And so when we travel, I look at it as a continued educational process when we meet with legislative people, whether it's or even at the White House. I was at the White House basically a month ago or so, on an educational journey, because they don't know anything really about Native people, and especially even Seneca people. And so, it's a struggle, and we have to do our part as Native nations to be able to engage with our local representatives, our local communities, and schools, to make sure that they know and understand who we are, and that we're still here, and that what our nations are all about. Because if we don't, we get forgotten. And so we've really been on a strong initiative in regards to that whole process. Not only that, but then we have to advocate for our issues, and they gain an understanding. I think the more we engage with them and tell our story and talk about who we are, our history, and our present-day nations, they're interested and they get to understand that and realize that. It's funny because when I go to Albany or Washington, I have to take a map with me now because they don't know where we are. Do you know the Seneca Nation? Do you know about this? Do you know about that? No, no, no. Well, here it is. And so we have to go into a 10-minute condensed version of a history lesson for them so they get a glimpse of what we're talking about and who we are. And then we have to follow that up with follow-up information so that they have something to fall back on and to read and to know about who we are. And so it's a struggle. And when you go to the top leader in the House of Representatives and he says, I didn't know there were Indians in New York, you know, that's a problem.
All right, I want to go back to Dr. Quigley. Can you give us an example of the kinds of words and concepts to watch out for that people intend to use on minimizing Indian boarding school history? Can you answer that question?
I'm not really sure what they would use to minimize the history of the boarding school. I just hope that people acknowledge that this is an actual part of American history, that these boarding schools were actually schools that did so much harm to our people generationally, that I hope that these are part of the healing truths that come out in curriculum that people will learn about. And I do hope that when Ferry's curriculum are adopted, that it is told from our perspective, because so much of the history that is there in curriculum right now is not even necessarily the right history because of the perspective that it's been told from. So I do hope that it's simply the truth about the history, the historical accounts, and more. I'm not in favor of really delving into the serious personal archives that do exist here and there about the children who attended those schools, but as a whole, what happened and those impacts on our communities, on our extended families. Certainly, we've lost an awful lot. As President Seneca pointed out, we need to, you know, rebuild our language. We need to, you know, rebuild our culture. It's much more than that. We need to rebuild our communities and our families.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Lori. We'll be back after this break. We are talking about boarding school reconciliation and acknowledgement. We're at 1-800-996-2848.
Global business executives, top government officials, diplomats, and indigenous leaders will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Arctic Encounter is where global decisions meet northern realities. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show. There are more than 120 Alaskans awaiting a life-saving organ transplant. You can save up to 8 lives and make a difference in your community as an organ donor. It's important to get informed, register, and let your loved ones know your decision. Learn more from Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization that stewards the gift of life for all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Indigenous leaders, diplomats, top government officials, and global business executives will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond to explore community resilience, critical infrastructure, and traditional knowledge in the age of great power competition and shifts. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. There's still time to join our discussion about boarding school updates and news. Soon, we'll check in with a group in Rapid City, South Dakota, memorializing boarding school victims and survivors through a statue. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Dr. Samuel Torres. He is the deputy CEO for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. He is Mexica and Nahua. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Samuel.
Thank you for having me on the show today. It's always good to be in discussion with you.
All right. So in April, the Trump administration took back a $1.5 million grant from your organization. What would that money have done for the work you do there at the Healing Coalition?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And first of all, I just want to say it's a pleasure to be here alongside the tribal leaders and thought leaders joining us today for this important discussion. And at the beginning of April, we were notified that over $1.5 million of boarding school research and healing programs were being cut by the National Endowment for the Humanities. The portion that was a part of our coalition's responsibility was that of a $500,000 cooperative agreement. And so being in the very start of year two of those funds, more than half of those monies were being requested back in the termination of that grant. And specific to that work that we were doing with the cooperative agreement with the National Endowment for Humanities was a strong, robust digital archives preservation work that our organization has been developing with our own funds and outside funders for a really long time. And this cooperative agreement was an encouraging move in the direction that we felt was an important move towards upholding that trust responsibility to tribal nations to make those archival records more easily accessible to boarding school survivors, to descendants of boarding school survivors, to tribal leaders, to tribal citizens whose information rightly belong to them. It has been our endeavor to always, guided by the important principles of indigenous data sovereignty, to ensure that the materials that and information about tribal people are able to be in the hands of tribal people. So this funding cut set us back quite a bit. It continues to actually create quite a swell of cataloging backlog for us to be able to put those materials on our National Indian Boarding School Digital Archive, which was released in its initial iteration just May of 2024, so a little over 1 year ago, with over 526 boarding school institutions that we have identified with the support of so many individual independent researchers and, of course, Secretary Holland's Department of the Interior, it's a large number that is going to require some sustained momentum and effort. So this was quite a hit to us, and we know other institutions, orgs, and tribes as well, because this is work that is going to need to be done regardless of if that federal funding is there or not.
Got it. And a lot of people who are losing these this funding from the federal government are hoping to, reach out to philanthropic organizations. Do you hope that philanthropic organizations will be able to fill the hole of federal funding?
Well, I think that's an important short-term fill right now that we are really compelling our friends and allies outside of Indian country to be able to step up to fill that void. Almost every space that we walk into, and when given the opportunity and chance to share about the impact, the intergenerational trauma, the stories of forced removal, you know, the impacts of stolen language, land, and loss of culture and lifeways. There's always folks that are interested in helping and supporting and standing in solidarity. And so right now stands as an important moment for those philanthropic interests to be able to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. So we certainly hope so. But on the other side of that, we very much feel that, and the position of NABS really, and of course informed by and affirmed by boarding school survivors, descendants, tribal leaders, is ultimately that those programs, such as the ones that were canceled by the NEH recently in April, those programs that have federal support and federal funding, those funds that were congressionally appropriated, seeking to address historical and ongoing impacts of boarding schools, that now that they're being cut, we see that as a failure to uphold that trust responsibility. We were notified by the National Endowment for the Humanities that those grants that were canceled were, in their words, at variance with agency priorities, including but not limited to those on diversity, equity, and inclusion and environmental justice initiatives. Now, we don't see this work as diversity, equity, and inclusion. We never have. The work of the truth, seeking truth and advocacy and healing from boarding schools is a sovereignty issue, and that continues to be our stance.
All right, and there's legislation on boarding school history that was introduced by Senator Murkowski of Alaska. What's the status of that bill, and what would it do?
So Senate Bill 761 is the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. The reintroduction of this bill is an important one, and it would create a commission for a fact-finding commission that would bring boarding school survivors, tribal leaders, thought leaders, and ultimately create a space where perhaps for the first time, the federal government takes a long, hard look at the impacts of boarding schools. And so in this multi-year commission, we would hope to be able to see the ability for the federal government to start walking that path towards addressing the impacts and the harms for a group of commissioners from Indian country to be able to come up with a set of calls to action or a series of guiding actions that could help the United States as a society, as a political entity, as a nation state, to be able to move towards reckoning with that history and supporting the tribal nations within these lands with the resources and the support that is truly deserved.
All right. Thank you so much, Samuel. I want to go over to our last guest here with the last remaining minutes of the show. Joining us from Rapid City, South Dakota, is Amy Sazu. She is the executive director of Remembering the Children. She is Sichangu and Oglala Lakota. Welcome to Native America Calling, Amy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you were involved in helping to install a statue that was just dedicated to the children who suffered at the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. It's titled Te Wahi. Can you tell us, first of all, what it looks like and who some of the artists and other contributors were?
Sure. So the sculpture is actually placed on the Remembering the Children Memorial site, which is a 24-acre site dedicated to the children who died at the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. Part of the initial plans were to use art and interpretive elements to tell parts of the story, to appeal to the human nature of all of it, to appeal to the human nature of non-Native people in our community and beyond. And just really use art as a way of telling a story. So we created this collaborative sculpture called Te Wahi with artist Dale Lamphere. But also, so Dale Lamphere is a well-known artist. He's the Artist Laureate of South Dakota. He's non-Native and has been in his field for about 40 years. He's done some, he's made Dignity, which stands as an honor to Native women. But Dale came on board and started helping. So he has the ability to do that, being an artist in his field for so long. He's built the capacity around himself to be able to do pro bono work. So he started helping us with this idea and conceptualizing it, and worked with our team for the last almost five years, bringing in Lakota and Dakota elders, spiritual leaders, members of our team, boarding school survivors, local youth in our community, to the sculpture. He did kind of started it, got a basic idea of what we wanted it to look like, and took the advice and input of all of the community members to really make it meaningful, incorporate all of the input, advice of the people most closely impacted. And it's beautiful. It's a bronze sculpture. Tiwahe means family in the Lakota language. And it just reminds us that these children had families, communities, and futures that were taken from them. This sculpture, this is meant to kind of reunite them with their family and bring their memory back into our living families today, like help us understand what boarding schools did to the family unit, not just the nuclear family, but our extended families as well. So it's a sculpture of a father. So the nuclear unit, the mom, the dad, there's a son and a daughter. The father is facing east and is kind of the, you'll see his face when you pull into the driveway. And he has his arms back, one arm back, kind of protecting his family in a protective kind of stance. And there's a mother who's very, you can just tell, is distraught with what is happening, what she's seen happen to the children and her family. And she's facing the wall. So we have a memorial wall that has the names of the children that died at this particular school. And she's facing them. There's a little sister that's kind of being hidden and protected by the mom and the dad. And then there's a son who is in a boarding school uniform and whose face really captures a little bit about what they were feeling. You know, there's some trepidation, some maybe a little bit of anger, his hands kind of clenched. And then in the middle of the sculpture are the grandma and the grandpa that kind of fading into the past. And then on the top of the sculpture in the middle of the family is a dome with 50 lights cut out. We have a light that shines from within the sculpture, shining upward. And the artist really wanted to send this message, like, our people, Lakota people, believe that we travel the Milky Way after we end our time here on Earth, to go back to the star camp, back to the rest of our relatives. And so he loved the idea of making a light pathway to the sky and really like giving them that path back to the Milky Way. It's beautiful. There's places, little enclaves where you can put sage and burn sage, and the sage comes up through the middle where that light comes out. It's beautiful. It just really captures a lot of what we feel now, what our relatives and ancestors must have felt at the time. And you can see it on the faces. And the reason that it's so authentic is Dale's hands might have created it, but he was taking the input, the stories, the advice, the life experiences of people, of Lakota and Dakota people, and incorporating them in. And that's one of the things I'm really proud of, is that we were able to work in this collaborative nature, because there is a need for allies to join us in telling this story and reminding our communities and the larger, our country, that this is part, boarding schools are part of our history, and that we should be learning about them in boarding in school. I think it would answer a lot of questions for non-natives, but I think for Indian families too, it would help us all understand a little bit about why things are the way they are.
Okay. So more than 50 children died at the school in the early part of the 20th century. What would you like people to know about the history of this school, the Rapid City Indian Boarding School?
So this school has a very unique history. I would recommend going to our website. So it's rememberingthechildren.org, because a part of the boarding school, Federal Boarding School Initiative, that we don't really talk as much about, is how these schools were positioned to acquire land. And once the government had possession of that land, they were able to choose what to do with it afterwards. The Rapid City Indian Boarding School sat on about 1,400 acres of land in the west side of Rapid City. And when you look at that land, and we, our original research team looked at that, looked at those boundaries and understanding the, how big it was, that it was self-sustaining, that children worked there in these green spaces in Rapid City where there's ball fields and parks. 100 years ago, our kids were working there. And after this school closed, the local community wanted access to that land. And so the distribution of the 1,400 acres that the Rapid City Indian Boarding School once sat on shaped the west side of Rapid City. And we don't talk about that. And in the distribution of that land, Indian people are also left out, although they were named in the statute that Congress had issued. And thus it leads to kind of some connectors to maybe some of the things we see today as far as race relations in Rapid City. You know, Rapid City has this moniker, racist city, for several reasons. And I mean, this history, this is just from that statute was issued in 1948. If you look at the history of Rapid City, the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, we've had some difficult relationships, inability to maybe understand each other or show empathy or understanding, and this really contributes to that. So understanding the local history and the impact on what we see today and people today is important, and I think everybody in our community would.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of the hour. I'd like to say thank you to our guests. We just heard from Amy Sazu. We also had Vice President Tasha Musseau, President J.C. Seneca, Dr. Lori Quigley, and Dr. Samuel Torres. Join us again on Monday for a discussion on the uncertainty over the future of national monuments protecting land that is important to tribes. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Sean Spruce. Our producers are Sol Traverso and myself, Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPaulin is the digital producer. Nola Dave Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer and the president of and CEO of Kiwanek Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend.
Keshe, guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what healthcare checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Elahqua.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanek Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.